Welcome to Behind the Headlines, a weekly recap of Utah news by the Salt Lake Tribune. This week on the program, former Utah Attorney General Mark Shurtleff and his daughter make an appearance on Utah's Capitol Hill, blasting law enforcement for the way that they executed a search warrant and raided their home. How are lawmakers thinking about the tactics used by the FBI? State legislators figure out a temporary way to deal with hundreds of unprocessed rape kits. So will local police departments go along? And the city of Bluffdale bypasses the State Records Committee, setting up its own way to deal with public records requests. Does this have anything to do with the NSA coming to town? All that and Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. Stay tuned for Behind the Headlines coming up after the news. Welcome to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. Today on the program, we've got fraud, we've got secrecy, outrage, and much more. And joining me this morning is Tribune State Government reporter Robert Gerke. And Robert, great to have you back.
Thank you. Good morning.
Also with us, City reporter Christopher Smart. Chris, hello.
Good morning.
And Justice reporter Nate Carlisle is in the studio. Nate, good morning.
Good morning, Jennifer.
And you can join us, too, if there's a news story you want to talk about. You can send your thoughts, your questions, and comments to the hashtag TribTalk on Twitter and Google+. You can put your comments on the website sltrib.com or call us live. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Let's start with outrage. Mark Shurtleff and his daughter made an appearance on Capitol Hill. Robert Gerke, what message did he deliver?
Well, it was interesting because obviously after the search warrant, there was a search warrant served on his home, and he was outraged by the manner in which it was executed. He said that officers came in brandishing weapons, pointing him at his children, trashed his house, you know, and basically behaved in a, well, he said they broke the law when they did it. Senator Todd Weiler, who over the last several months has been antagonistic, I think, toward Attorney General Shurtleff. He's not, they've had some testy exchanges via social media, was chairman of this committee and brought in the Department of Public Safety that was along on the warrant to sort of explain how it went down and their policies and procedures for executing these sorts of things. Their message was essentially that, well, we didn't actually, there are two phases to doing a warrant like this. You secure the premises and then you conduct the search. And they said the securing of the premises was actually done by the FBI. The DPS then came in and did the search. But they also said that the policies and procedures that are normally followed were followed in this case, and they did everything by the book. Attorney General Shurtleff, who made an unexpected appearance at the hearing, I mean, he was not invited to testify or anything. He just showed up with his daughter. Afterward, was dismissive of that explanation. He said that it's unconscionable for them to kind of claim that they have, you know, no culpability in this because the agent who swore out the affidavit to get the warrant is a DPS agent. He's been leading the investigation for the entire time, and he says that he made this allusion to that they will be made to answer on the witness stand, which, you know, prompted questions of whether he's planning to sue the DPS and the FBI for the way they executed this warrant. We asked him directly if he's planning a lawsuit. He didn't say that, you know, but he did indicate that he's, you know, that this is far from over in his eyes. And he thinks that he still thinks the tactics that they employed in this search were over the top and heavy-handed.
Did some legislators agree? Could you tell through their line of questioning?
There were some concerns expressed, especially by people. There's a representative, Mark Roberts, who has a pretty strong sort of libertarian bent, you know, to his philosophy. He expressed concerns, not necessarily about the Shurtleff warrant, but the way that other warrants in the past have been served on, you know, whether the tactics are abusive of people's, you know, personal property and liberty. And so there was some sympathy there, I think, from some of the members. Ultimately, Representative or Senator Weiler, who, again, like I said, is not a fan of Shurtleff, said at the end to the colonel from DPS, he said, "So just to be clear, you know, this you did everything according to the policies and procedures that have been in place and used for years." And the colonel said, "Yes, that was the case." So that was sort of the end of it. It doesn't appear that there's going to be an in-depth investigation by the legislature on this, but you know, it's the entire manner in which these warrants are executed is something that, you know, still bears some scrutiny, and we're still trying to find out exactly what transpired during that raid. The other thing, yesterday afternoon, finally, the FBI issued another statement that said they are standing by the previous statement by the Department of Public Safety that essentially said, you know, we have policies in place to protect the officers who are serving the warrant. We follow those policies. Everybody in the house was compliant, and there was no ruckus, I guess, that it went on when they were serving this warrant, and it was all done by the book.
Mm. Did Shurtleff's presence sort of change the atmosphere in that room?
It did. I mean, when he walked in, a lot of heads turned. You know, he sat there with his 17-year-old daughter. Afterwards, you know, there was a media scrum, a bunch of cameras around him asking him questions. He again reiterated that, you know, this has been really hard on his family, the entire investigation, and he's hopes it comes to some conclusion. He said, you know, one of the hardest parts is that he wasn't there to protect his family. It was curious that he brought his daughter, I think, and some people questioned why he would necessarily put her in the spotlight like that. I tried to ask her what she saw, if she could tell us what she saw, what she felt during mm-hmm. this, because she was the one that was in the home when the warrant was executed. And
the guns apparently were pointed at her.
And according to the attorney general, yeah, she was in the bathroom and was ordered out of the bathroom and had guns pointed at her as she came out of the bathroom.
Did she retell the story that way?
Well, no, Shurtleff kind of snapped and cut us off at that point. She's not going to talk. So she was there for, I guess, for the cameras, but not there to kind of talk to reporters. It was interesting that somebody who is in a position where he's under a great deal of scrutiny at this point, as he has been throughout this criminal investigation, would make a public appearance like that, you would assume he would have to know that there's going to be some media attention to that. I'm not exactly sure what the rationale was there, but you know, he said that he's going to continue to fight this and continue to press the issue. On the issue of the guns being pointed at her, the colonel, the DPS colonel, Fuhrer, who has been on numerous warrants, he said, you know, was asked by Senator Wyler how he would respond if somebody was in a bathroom and he didn't know who it was. And he says he would take up a defensive position behind cover and order them to come out of the bathroom. And Senator Wyler pressed it and said, "So is that exactly what appears to have happened in this case?" And he said, "Yes." I mean, the thinking being, I guess, that you don't know who's in there. You don't know if they're armed or not. And you need to defend yourself. He said these officers who execute these warrants have to go in there basically assuming the worst, you know, assuming so they can go home to their families at the end of the night.
Mm. And was there any conversation about the difference between executing a search warrant in a white collar crime case versus, the drug dealer down the corner?
Yeah, there are two kinds of warrants. Obviously, there's the knock and announce, which is what these were, where they knock on the door, wait for somebody to answer the door. If they answer the door, you hand them the warrant, go into the premises and secure the premises, and then conduct the search. In issues where there are potentially weapons, they're more dangerous, they're drug crimes, there are things like that, they do no-knock warrants where they basically knock down the door and go in, you know, with a SWAT team type setup. This was obviously a knock-and-announce warrant. According to Attorney General Shurtleff, the way it was served was they knocked on the door, his son answered the door, they served the warrant. Again, the same sort of scenario that played out when they served the warrant on former Attorney General Swallow's house. They knocked on the door was answered, handed them the warrant, and went in and secured the premises and conducted the search.
Mm. In other former Attorney General news,
yeah.
John Swallow, he's getting a new attorney. Why?
Well, that's an interesting question. His attorney throughout for probably closing in on 2 years has been Rod Snow, who's a very prominent criminal defense attorney in town. He represented Swallow aggressively throughout the investigations conducted by the Department of Justice and the state and the county attorneys, and through the investigations by the Lieutenant Governor's office and the House of Representatives. He said that this week that, you know, that they have come to a mutual conclusion that it was best that he find another attorney, and they're in the process of transitioning, and that should be complete next week.
The scuttlebutt is he can't afford it. That John Swallow's out of money there, and can't afford those big legal fees.
Yeah, there's a couple possible rationales. One is that the money's run out. There's also another theory, and Rod Snow didn't address this when I asked him the question, but he said there's also the potential. Rod Snow happened to have represented Mark Sessions Jensen at one point several years ago. Mark Jensen is now in the Davis County Jail, and he's expected to be a witness for the prosecution should there be any charges. Mm. That creates an interesting conflict of interest where he's representing or he's defending one client when the witness for the prosecution is somebody else he's represented, which led some people who are, you know, attorneys and fairly informed on this to suggest that perhaps we're now nearing a stage where they're considering mounting a defense to criminal charges. Again, that's as you put it, scuttlebutt. It's not something that Rod or John have confirmed. His new attorney, as I understand it, is also a pretty prominent defense attorney. He hasn't confirmed that he's going to be taking on John as a client, so I shouldn't mention his name, I guess, because there are attorney-client issues, I guess, that they're still preserving. But you know, he's moving to a new attorney, and presumably will be the attorney throughout the rest of this this investigation. And should there be charges, the defense.
Should there be charges is. We don't have any indication when that could come down, right?
You know, they're still very active. I learned this week that they are still serving subpoenas for documents on people. You know, they're still very much active in terms of gathering evidence. Again, what we have to go on basically is what Sim Gill said. Wow, how long ago was it now? 6 weeks ago that they were, you know,
they were forthcoming.
That they
or
were.
Something.
He said they were at the time. He said they were, you know, six to 12 weeks out, basically. So we're in that window. But from all indications, and given the activity of the investigators, you'd have to think that they're probably still putting together a case if they do indeed pursue charges.
Mm-hmm. It was interim week. Lawmakers met on Capitol Hill. Let's shift gears a little bit and go to a hot button issue: rape kits. There's been a real backlog on rape kits. That's the evidence that's gathered right after a woman reports a sexual assault. Legislators say they're ready to do something about it. Christopher Smart, what's the plan?
Well, they're tussling with this issue. It's not just a Utah or Salt Lake City issue. It's a national issue. Came to light last month when Kyle Amalfa asked Police Chief Chris Burbank why he had a backlog of some 788 rape kits that had not been processed by the crime lab. And so it's a very emotional issue, both from the standpoint of victims and victim advocates and by investigators. Burbank's response was that they do everything they can to prosecute these cases, and if a rape kit will strengthen the case, then they go ahead and send it to the crime lab. But he complained that the crime lab is so understaffed that it takes up to 6 months or more to get these things analyzed. And this was actually building. Representative Jennifer Selig, a Democrat, had introduced the issue up on the Hill last session. And she was successful in getting some money, $750,000, to help with this backlog.
So that money's going to go to the state crime lab to help them catch up?
No. What happened earlier this week at the committee hearing was that the head of the state crime lab said they would contract with a private lab to do this work. And so in the meantime, they hope that the legislature will fund the crime lab so it can build up its capabilities over time. But this would be a stopgap measure so that any law enforcement agency could take this immediately to this private crime lab and get it analyzed in a quick fashion. Mm. Now, whether that happens, how much of that happens, I don't know, because the Salt Lake City Police said that wouldn't really change their modus operandi. The advocates, however, say that in places like New Orleans and Detroit, where they have gotten the funding to analyze these rape kits that are backlogged, years old, they've been able to get convictions. And so what we have here really is we don't really know how many rapes there are, but experts tell us that only a small percentage are ever reported. Of those that are reported, only a very small percentage get prosecuted. So it's a big problem. It's an emotional problem, and it's got the advocates in this case, Salt Lake City Police, crossways with each other.
Hmm. Speaking of advocates, a question from Holly Mullen. She's with the Rape Recovery Center. Can your panel members address why they think Salt Lake City Police Chief Chris Burbank continues to fight against the notion that all rape kits should be sent to the state crime lab for testing? Theories?
Well, I can tell you what they say is that they say that they don't need to do that, and in some cases it's a waste of money. They say if they know who the perpetrator is, then there's no sense sending that in for DNA testing, because the DNA testing would help identify the perpetrator. They also say that in a number of these cases, the victims at a certain point don't want to go forward with prosecution. Now, as Holly has stated on a number of occasions publicly, that is an interesting phenomenon. And also, I was discussing this with Salt Lake City Councilman Kyle LaMalfa, who asked this question. Why would a rape victim go through this process? A rape kit is where a specially trained nurse comes in and examines you and takes swabs, and it's very invasive, and it takes a long time. It takes hours. So why would a rape victim go through that and then later come and say, well, never mind, I don't want to prosecute the case? Mm-hmm. And so Holly wonders aloud about the interaction between the investigators and the victims, and whether there's a complete understanding of the emotional trauma that the victim is going through, and whether that interaction with the cops leads them to walk away.
Robert?
While we're putting words in Holly's mouth, well, let me just add this. I think that the advocates have also suggested that given the extensive DNA databases that they have now, when they get these rape kits back, they can also indicate if you have a serial rapist. You can find if somebody who's offended has reoffended or committed similar crimes in the past. One of the other funding issues they had is that in the past legislative session was that these nurses that Chris was talking about who process these rape kits, who gather the evidence, I guess, they were running out of money for those. The state had this account set up, but they kept going to this account and raiding it to pay for other things, and they were in jeopardy of running out of money before the end of the year. They did get some additional money for that, so presumably through the end of the fiscal year, they'll have enough of these nurses who are trained to gather these kits and send, so they can be sent off.
Mm. Another step in a developing story. Salt Lake Tribune reporters Robert Gerke, Christopher Smart, and Nate Carlisle are in the house, and you're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW. You can join us as well. The number 801-355-TALK, 801-355-8255. Send us a tweet to the hashtag TribTalk or put your comments at sltrib.com. We need to take a quick break. We'll be right back. Stay with us. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune, and joining me this hour, Tribune reporters Robert Gerke, Chris Smart, and Nate Carlisle. And you can join us as well. You can send your thoughts to the hashtag TribTalk. You can put your comments at sltrib.com or give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Let's go to the court system. Yesterday, Salt Lake County DA Sim Gill filed charges against a West Valley police officer. Nate Carlisle, what happened?
Well, we have to go back to November 2, 2012, as Danielle Willard is what they believe observing, what the police thought was a drug deal. She is backing out of a parking spot when Detective Sean Cowley and Kevin Salmon come up to her. She is backing the car out of the parking spot, and Sean Cowley claims he was in the path of the car and that the bumper, rear bumper hit him, and so he fired his weapon. Kevin Salmon then, who's on the other side of the car, then fires his weapon. But Sim Gill claims the evidence shows Sean Cowley was not in the path of the car. The first shot was fired from the side of the car, striking and killing Danielle Willard. So yesterday, 19 months after the shooting, he filed a second-degree manslaughter charge against Sean Cowley. However, there were no charges filed against Kevin Salmon. It remains to be seen if Salmon's going to go back to work at West Valley City. He's been on administrative leave this entire time. Cowley's been fired, but not for shooting Willard. He was fired for mishandling evidence, according to the West Valley City Police Department in an investigation that followed.
19 months. 19 months of internal investigations, discipline. What took so long? I guess that's the question a lot of people have on their minds.
Yeah. A few things here. First of all, there were a lot of investigations, or I should say a lot of investigators from different departments. Sim Gill claims only a week and a half ago the latest expert came in to look at the case. Everyone was reviewing this. There were some things that were found related to the shooting that I'm sure delayed the case. You know, as I mentioned, the evidence handling issues. But then it appears, by all accounts, that at least at one point, Sim Gill wanted to take this case to a grand jury rather than file charges himself. And if he'd been able to go to a grand jury, you know, it would have been a panel of citizens who could have looked at the case and say, yes or no, we think charges should be filed. But he ran into some legal hurdles there, procedural hurdles in going to the grand jury, so finally, he decided to make his own decision about which and whether to file charges.
Reaction from Danielle Willard's mother. She was very critical of the West Valley Police Department when this first happened.
Danielle Willard's mother says she's pleased with the decision. She's okay with no charges against Salmon. She would have preferred a murder charge against Cowley, but she recognizes that the evidence may not have existed for a murder charge.
Hmm. What about the West Valley Police Department? They've been under scrutiny for months.
There's a new chief there now, and he said yesterday that he would respect Sim Gill's decision. And meanwhile, they're going to start finishing their administrative investigation into Kevin Salmon and determining if and when he can return to the West Valley City Police Department. Both detectives are still getting support from the Fraternal Order of Police, who do not like the way this was handled by Sim Gill for some of the reasons we mentioned. It's gone on so long, and they didn't like the fact that Cowley was charged at all. It has been a long 19 months. You think everything that's gone on with the protest against the police department and in support of Danielle Willard, the police chief resigned in the middle of this for what he said was health reasons, and I don't know. I guess this may end with John Cowley either being acquitted or convicted, but we'll see. I suspect is not completely over yet. Daniel Woolley's mother has filed a civil lawsuit in federal court. Just there's still a lot of things happening with this matter.
Mm-hmm. A manslaughter charge. What's the penalty if found guilty?
He could face up to 15 years in prison.
So serious.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's a serious felony charge.
Let's move on to another police story that's made headlines this week. One of Salt Lake City's police chief deputies retired under a cloud. And, Nate, you obtained some documents this week that revealed the circumstances surrounding that retirement. Give us the details.
Yeah, I mean, the documents quote witnesses as saying that Deputy Chief Rick Finley, in about the 2011-2012 time frame, had photographs on his phone showing subordinates in bikinis and, in one case, a naked subordinate, and was showing these around to other police officers. The department apparently got wind of this. I should say the administration got wind of this last year, and an investigation started. And aside from those facts, I should clarify, Finley denies showing a nude photo and said something to the effect if he showed some of the bikini photos, he was probably only showing it to a good friend of his. It looks like all the facts in this case were known as early as January. That's when the second of two city departments finished a report on this.
So, and give us the timeline again.
Okay, so it looks like, according to the timeline, that the police department found out about this in April of last year. Finley is put on leave in November, and in December, the Salt Lake City Civilian Review Board looks at this issues a report. 3 weeks later, the city's Human Resources Department looks at this and issues a report. And then nothing happens much of this until March, when Finley, who is according to city policies, is allowed a disciplinary hearing where he can challenge the findings. He waives that hearing. And then it looks like nothing happened on this until June 4, when Finley has now hit his 20 years of service, which makes him eligible for all kinds of retirement benefits. He puts in his retirement. Chief Burbank issues a final letter expressing his disappointment in Finley, but saying this was not a fireable offense. But because Finley has elected to retire, the chief is not, does not issue any discipline. I mean, it'd be a moot point.
And the investigation ends.
So
Chief Burbank basically says, bad move, but you've served the city well?
Yes, in so many words.
Okay. So the outside citizen panel, you said that the Civilian Review Board,
yes,
took a look at this. What did they say?
They found that he did violate the sexual harassment policies and did violate the policy that it's called conduct on becoming an officer, which can be kind of a broad spectrum of things, but it basically means the police officer did something to disservice his uniform. The City Human Resources Department comes to the same conclusion, but they've got some other things to say about Finley, specifically that he was evasive and his answers were not believable when the internal affairs questioned him about the photos. And that's an important point, because if Finley were to have continued as a police officer, that probably would have followed him to a witness stand in a criminal case one day. That's why it was a little surprising when Chief Burbank wrote in the letter that he didn't think it was a fireable offense, because if that had followed Finley to the witness stand, I don't know. Granted, he was in an administrative post, but if he'd been demoted to doing something where he would have had to testify frequently, that would have really been problematic.
Certainly a black mark on the police department. What do the mayor and the city council members, have they weighed in on this at all?
No. In fact, the mayor's spokesman, when I called him this week to ask about it, apparently the mayor hadn't even reviewed the documents, and said Chief Burbank has full discretion to make decisions in these matters.
Hmm. Let's move on to another city issue. Bluffdale this time. In the South Valley, the city of Bluffdale has decided to go its own way when it comes to open records. Chris Smart, you reported on this.
I did, and so did Nate Carlisle. A little bit of history is that my colleague Nate Carlisle last year wanted to find out how much water the new Utah data center, the NSA's giant computer data complex, was using. And they get their water from Bluffdale, and because they're in Bluffdale. So he put in a grammar request for that information, and the city turned him down. According to procedure, he then appealed it to the city manager, who turned him down. And then the Tribune and Nate took the matter to the State Records Committee. And in March, the State Records Committee voted 5-0 that Bluffdale should turn over the water records because they weren't going to, you know, violate the security of the water records weren't going to violate national security.
Let me intervene there. So, Nate, what did the records say?
Well, first, my records request was broader than just asking for the water usage. I asked for correspondence between the National Security Agency and Bluffdale. I asked for copies of contracts, and that turned out to be important because we saw that Bluffdale struck an agreement with the NSA on what they would charge them for water, and the agreement had a below market rate for the National Security Agency. Bluffdale had an explanation for why that was. They wanted to use the money to invest in infrastructure in the South and the Valley. But my point here is that the water records is only the point that we disagreed on to the point of going to the State Records Committee. There's a lot of things we asked for from Bluffdale, and we got just about all of it. But there's things we're going to want to know in the future. And now, instead of going to a neutral third party who could issue a ruling one way or the other on whether the records should be released, it's going to be Bluffdale's city council. And we still have the option, if you know we don't like the ruling we get from Bluffdale City Council, I mean records requesters, of going to state court. But man, that is expensive, and litigation can drag on, and it's lawsuits are not a preferable option.
Mm-hmm. Well, Chris, so this week Bluffdale decides to set up its own sort of records review committee,
right?
The city council, right?
And that's fine under Utah law. The State Records Committee is mandatory when you're dealing with a state agency. But any municipality under Utah law can have its own appeals board, or they can have no appeals board at all.
How many cities actually have their own appeals board?
I have no idea. Hmm. But the West Valley City, for example, has its own appeals board, and Nate can tell you the problem that the Tribune has run into there when the paper sought records in the Susan Powell case. Mm. and was having to deal with West Valley City review panel instead of a state panel. And so under Utah law, they can have no panel at all. So if you get denied, you have to go straight to court. This is something that comes up at the legislature every year practically, but so far, you know, unless a city wants to include the State Records Committee in its appeals process, then it just doesn't have to.
Mm. Did Bluffdale actually say this is a result of harassment by Nate Carlisle of the Salt Lake Tribune?
No, actually quite the opposite. I asked the city attorney there why. Was this the outcome of this tussle with the Tribune? Mm-hmm. And he said it had absolutely nothing to do with, the battle over water records. But rather, he said that it would be a more timely way to deal with records.
Robert?
I suspect, as Chris mentioned, these sorts of issues come up pretty frequently at the legislature, and this has arisen fairly recently, but I would not be surprised to see some lawmakers weigh in on this.
I'd like to give a little more context to the issue of a municipality being its own records board.
Sure.
As I've argued a lot of records appeals in this state, I have never been successful when a city or county has been the last administrative stop in the appeals process. I'm batting about 2/3 at the State Records Committee. I'm 0-3 or 0-4, I can't remember which it is, at cities and counties who have their own records board.
Right, and you got to contrast the two. You've got the State Records Committee that's made up of a panel of people who have at least acquired some expertise in state records law, mm-hmm. and an understanding of what is supposed, you know, the whole concept of public records versus protected records, as opposed to what you get at a city council, which is a bunch of people who don't have any experience with this, listening to a city attorney who has a vested interest in keeping this stuff concealed, and you know, it's a totally unlevel playing field, and I'll just step off my soapbox.
Okay.
After that.
Well, I guess the question people out in radio land might be asking themselves: why should I care about this? Why do I need access to public records? And Nate, give your best pitch, because this Bluffdale case has really raised some red flags for open records advocates.
Yeah, I mean, there's actually a lot of city records a citizen might be interested in at some point. Whether you want to know why the police were raiding the neighbor next door yesterday, or you want to examine, you know, the property taxes and how tax dollars are being spent in your community. This is what you hear a lot, that records laws are special interest for journalists. But if you look at who files records requests, because we looked at this in Salt Lake City and Salt Lake County a few years ago, journalists are not the most frequent records requesters. It's actually businesses, especially lawyers representing businesses.
Mm-hmm.
And I would just add that, I mean, city government is the level of government closest to the people. If our listeners think about which government has the most direct day-to-day impact on their lives, that it's those city governments. They're the ones who do their planning and zoning and city budgets. And those are the things that people are going to want to know about that have a direct impact on them. And when you have you can't fight City Hall, I guess, mentality, it could ultimately end up being a real problem. I mean, and again, as Nate said, it's not about us in the media. It's about the citizens wanting to know what's going on in their government. Their recourse now in the case of Bluffdale, in the case of West Valley and some other cities, is going to ultimately be in the hands of these elected officials who can disclose what they want or not disclose what they want.
Mm. Well, and it's not just disclosing the record. I mean, one big issue in the dispute the Tribune had with Bluffdale was Bluffdale wanted to charge us, I can't remember, $700-some or $800-some for not just the water records, but the other records we'd acquired earlier. And that issue went to the State Records Committee, too. And the State Records Committee knocked it down to about $335, so about half or 40% of what Bluffdale wanted. And now Bluffdale is, you know, they're going to set what fees they think are reasonable, and then the city council is going to have to decide on that issue too, not just whether the records are disclosed, but whether the citizen or journalist should actually pay the full dollar amount that the city manager and city attorney say is reasonable.
Mm. So West Valley City has set up its own little system. Bluffdale now, this week. Chris Smart, or other cities saying, maybe we should look at this too?
I'm sure they are. But so you've got this strange thing going on where, for example, in Salt Lake City, Mayor Ralph Becker's is all about transparency. He wants his city to be as transparent as possible. And then you have, and that's sort of what you get around the municipal elections when folks are running for office. But in the case of the smaller municipalities like Bluffdale, where you have an appointed city manager rather than an elected mayor as the chief executive, then you get a situation where there's this sort of, I don't know if it's, there's a sort of notion that, you know, less information is better for the administrators. More public information is more trouble. Mm-hmm. And as Robert said, is the city council is going to listen to the city attorney on, you know, what to do. So you have these part-time councils and lay people. And so I don't know. It's going to be up to each and every municipality to decide how open they want to be, and they're always afraid that they might be getting sued, and so it's a defensive measure.
Robert, do you think the state lawmakers are going to step in?
Well, like I said, I think it probably is ripe for them to at least look at it. They made some fairly dramatic revisions to the grandma law a few years ago. I don't know that this issue was specifically addressed at the time. I don't recall if it was. One point to follow up on what Chris said, when you get to an appeal, you've already been rejected by the city administrator, right? And presumably the city attorney has weighed in on that. So you've already kind of got this deck stacked against you when you go in there. One point about the legislature that writes the laws on open records for the state has also exempted themselves from the State Records Committee. They work exactly like Bluffdale City and West Valley. If you have a records request to them that is denied by their council, you go to a panel of legislative leaders who then decide whether or not they're going to give that to you based on the advice, again, of their council. And if that fails, then you go to the Third District Court. So it's not unique, but it also creates a pretty high bar for and really an uphill battle for journalists and citizens, as Nate mentioned, citizens being primary users of these to get the information that should rightfully be theirs.
And this is a tweet from Joe Pyra, who is the
Hi, Joe.
the chief of staff for House Speaker Becky Lockhart. He says the bill is already drafted. So, well, I'm sure we'll find out more about that. We need to take off to another break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW. Joining me in studio, Tribune reporters Robert Gerke, Nate Carlisle, and Christopher Smart. We'll be right back after a break. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune, and Chris Smart, Nate Carlisle, and Robert Gerke are in the studio with me, and you can join us too. 801-355-TALK is our number. And Robert, a correction.
Well, I think Joe was actually making a joke about a different bill that may be drafted.
Okay.
We may still see legislative action, but I don't think it's quite that far along.
All right. Apologies, Joe. Let's move on to polygamy. Nate, a bit of news coming out of the Utah Supreme Court this week with regards to the United Effort Plan. What's going on?
Right. The Utah Supreme Court this week cleared the way to subdivide property in the town of Hilldale, Utah. And that sounds like a painfully boring municipal issue. But in fact, it's could be very important to eventually getting the state out of the business of running a polygamous trust. The property in Hilldale in adjoining Colorado City, huge parcels exist where you've got entire town blocks in one parcel. And that's made it difficult to sell property and to give property away to people who have rightful claims on homes. So now the Supreme Court has said that Hilldale can be subdivided, and the paperwork was supposed to be filed this week with Washington County, and we could see more people getting their homes instead of living in basically community property.
And so this means a lot, not just to the residents there, but to everyone in the state, because the state is operating this trust.
Correct. Operating the trust and is paid to run the trust, and that's raised all kinds of questions in the last few years.
Okay. We've only got a few minutes left. I want to get to our underplayed story of the week, the story that could result in many more headlines in the weeks to come. And Robert, what's your pick?
Well, Lee Davidson had a story about legislators and Transportation Commission looking at another $1 billion in bonding for roads, borrowing money to build these roads, which is something they've not been shy about doing over the last several years. The reason this becomes an issue is because the state currently already has a very high debt. It's over $3 billion, about $1,100 per person per capita in the state. They're paying it down, but, you know, if you're looking at bonding another $1 billion for roads and there's already talk of bonding to build a new prison, our conservative legislature has been taking on mountains of debt recently, and there have been some who have expressed some concerns about what it might end up doing to the state's credit rating.
Okay. Transportation, always a big issue.
I know, it's sexy.
It's so sexy. Christopher Smart, what's your pick?
This is a sexy one. This is the subject that Salt Lakers love to hate. Parking.
Parking.
Earlier this week, three citizens sued Salt Lake City for its parking kiosks, for its electronic parking system that many people loathe. But their contention is that it violates Salt Lake City code. They say that when the new system was installed, the city code was not updated properly, and so that it is their claim it's illegal for the city to collect parking fines. Of course, this comes after 2 years of a sort of a drumbeat by visitors and residents alike who don't like the system because it's not easy to use for some. It has a lot of bugs. And last summer, it even ceased to exist for about a week during the heat of July.
And everybody missed it, right?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, parking lawsuit. Okay, Nate Carlisle, your pick.
My interplayed story of the week broke kind of late yesterday, so I'm cheating a little bit because it's early. But I'm taking the Rick Korber having his fraud case dismissed. This was the guy that marketed himself as the free capitalist. We all saw the billboards up and down I-15 years ago. It's alleged he cost investors millions. The charges could be refiled, but it does not look good for the federal government wanting to prosecute Rick Korber right now.
Okay. That is a huge case, and he is somewhat in the shirtless controversy,
yeah,
right, Robert?
Yeah. Originally, the Department of Commerce brought the case to the Attorney General's office. The Attorney General declined to prosecute. There were allegations that Rick was calling in favors from state legislators to put pressure on it. The Commerce, Francine Gianni, took the case to the U.S. Attorney, who ended up filing the charges, and then it sat and sat and sat, and now apparently the judge is saying it sat too long, we're going to throw it out. It's cleaning out the refrigerator, I guess.
Okay. My pick for the story, underplayed story of the week, is one that actually is in today's paper. It's authored by our colleague Thomas Burr out of Washington, and it shows how our representatives are making a little extra money on the side. They are writing books. So if you haven't read the story, check it out. Chris Smart, Nate Carlisle, Robert Gerke of the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks, everybody, very much for your time today.
Thank you. Have a great day.
And we're going to wrap up today's program with a conversation with Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. And this week, Kirby remembers an incident in a parking lot.
I was visiting someone in the hospital, and I parked in the hospital parking lot, LDS Hospital. And in there, you know, covered parking. And when I was done, I came back out, and there was this note on my car from someone who apparently had scraped my truck or something like that, which was laughable considering the number of scrapes that are already on it. I mean, I looked and couldn't find it.
You got to read this note. It's great.
Here's the note. And her name was Kim. Nice lady, little, you know, younger girl. When I met her, she was really apologetic. She left this note on my windshield. Dear 4Runner owner, I regretfully brushed the side of your car with mine as I pulled in this morning. I left a couple of scratches on the outside rim of the right back wheel. I'm so sorry. Call me, please, if you need to discuss reimbursement. Sorry, Kim. And then she left her last name and her phone number.
And what has you so puzzled is just the lack of honesty that we see in the world. I mean,
yes, right.
We don't see this very often.
You really don't. My first thought was a profane one. There was no new visible damage. Quite obviously, Larry or Sonny or some other moron was trying to yank my chain. I searched the garage, peering into cars and even under them, trying to foil the prank. Nothing happened. I finally, and she, Kim, worked at LDS Hospital, so I finally went in and talked to her. I said, look, don't sweat it. This thing is so banged up. I don't know how you could possibly tell me which one of those scratches would be the one you put in there. And when somebody's dishonest, you just got to reward them. You know, you can't put them through the ringer. You owe me $100 or something like that.
I'm guessing you would not have left a note had the roles been reversed.
You know, I'd like to say that I would, but I'm like everybody else. I'd probably peek around to see if there were any cameras or any people watching and then slither away.
So when you actually met Kim, what did she say?
She kept trying to apologize, and I kept telling her that she didn't need to apologize, and I complimented her on her honesty, and we parted as friends.
So what's the moral of the story?
Well, the moral of the story is the same moral that it's always been, and that's the honesty is the best policy.
That's Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. And you can join us each week with the best from the Kirby Archive and find all of his columns on the website sltrib.com. A brief program note, the Salt Lake Tribune's book club, Utah Lit, is hosting a live event about the latest book on the Susan Powell disappearance. It's titled If I Can't Have You, authored by Rebecca Morris and Greg Olson. Rebecca Morris will be at our live event, as will Powell's best friend Kiersey Helliwell and Tribune reporter Nate Carlisle, who's covered the case for many years. And this live event is happening on Wednesday, June 25th at the Viridian Center in West Jordan. It starts at 7 o'clock. And if you can't attend live, you can hear a rebroadcast next Friday morning at 10 and then again Friday night at 8 o'clock right here on KCPW. So hope you can join us for a live event Wednesday, June 25th at the Viridian Center in West Jordan. The book If I Can't Have You by Rebecca Morris and Greg Olson. That's it for this edition of Behind the Headlines. The show is produced by the Salt Lake Tribune with support from Tyler Ford and Jesse Ellis. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.